follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, as presented by the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's show, I'm talking to writer-director James Ashcroft about his Netflix hit film, Coming Home in the Dark. Over the course of the interview, we talk about how he and his co-writer, Eli Kent, went about adapting the Owen Marshall short story, about the socio-political themes in the film, and how the movie feels kind of unusual by the standards of New Zealand horror. Elsewhere in the interview, I chat to James about his favourite types of horror, 70s horror, and his new project, a big screen adaptation of the Max Brooks novel, Devolution. All of which, and much, much more, you can hear right now in my interview with James. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Kia ora. Thanks for having me.
That's no problem at all. It's good to have you on. So we've got you on to talk about your career as a director and an actor and just your film career generally. But I suppose a good place to start the interview would be your film from last year, Coming Home in the Dark. And just for anybody who's maybe not seen it yet, can you give us a quick synopsis of Coming Home in the Dark?
Yeah, sure. I always refer to Coming Home in the Dark as a story about the perfect family outing of two parents and two children that gets interrupted by two men with a rifle. And from there, they go on a nightmare road trip into the heart of darkness.
That seems like a good summation of what happens in the film. Yeah, absolutely.
It's the best way I can be spoiler free as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's the film is a loose adaptation of a short story. What inspired you to make a film from that short story?
Well, I mean, I'm a big reader, and I was introduced to this story actually by my best friend Elric Kane. He was in the States, and I was speaking to him about Flannery O'Connor, a good man is hard to find, one of her most famous short stories, and he said, you know, we've got our own version of that story, Coming Home in the Dark by this guy, Owen Marshall. And I hadn't read any of Owen's work. I mean, he's a prolific short story writer. He's a just prolific author here in New Zealand. And I got a hold of this short story, and it was unlike anything that I'd read that had come out of New Zealand, that had come from, you know, the New Zealand literary scene. And it was a very powerful experience reading that short for the first time. It was I loved the tone. It was very cinematic in the way it was written. The tone really stuck with me, this picture of the beauty of New Zealand that Owen paints, and these terrifying, seemingly random acts of horror and violence that can erupt any time. And it really was one of those stories which it just sort of shatters that illusion of being anywhere and really feeling truly safe. And it was just one of those things that, you know, it just sticks with you, it haunts you. I mean, I'm always a big fan of, you know, if it doesn't haunt your sleep, then it's probably just a good idea in terms of projects. I'm always looking for something that really fights to sort of sink its claws into you and hang around in your consciousness after reading it for a long time. And I love the sketch of the characters that, you know, he did in 20 odd pages. These were incredibly well drawn, idiosyncratic characters that, you know, you wanted to spend more time with and know more about them. So that was really attractive. But in terms of turning it into a film, you know, it's ultimately the short story is really only about the first 20 minutes of our film. And originally it was a case of going, well, we like what the short film, the short story proposes in terms of adaptation, but we've seen that film before. You know, we've seen it a number of times and it's been done incredibly well before. So what Eli Kent, who co-wrote the script with me, he and I, we had to go exploring and bring other material into collision with that short story in order for it to, you know, speak to something more personal, more relevant, and make it more of a contemporary proposition for a cinema audience.
And how long was that kind of process in terms of like trying to work out what the larger story was going to be, you know, and fill in kind of parts of the characters' kind of bios and backstory and the broader themes that you play with in the movie?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of, I showed Eli the short story, he liked it, and then, you know, once we'd have this conversation about, you know, how to tackle it, we sort of put it aside and wrote three other scripts in between. And then finally we came back to it, you know, a couple of years later and started to really go, well, let's now that we've got our working relationship down pat, we've got our process in terms of how we like to work and develop work from these sort of, you know, these points of inspiration, like a short story or a large work, like a novel. We sort of said, let's tackle this because, you know, this feels about the right size as a debut feature. It's contained, it's character driven, it's got a very clear genre to it. So we probably spent a couple of months or maybe a bit more trying to, I'll just refer to it as the event. So there's an event that happens in the short story and in the film at the 15 minute mark. And we tried for a number of months to try and get around committing to that event. It's a moment of you know, extreme violence, and really it's a great, the thing that we ended up landing on why we kept it is because ultimately it means all bets are off from this point. You know, it really does pull the rug out from under its under the crowd, and it's a great way of sort of making people go, well, we have no idea where we're going to go next. But more so, once we finally committed to doing that event and made sense of it thematically, then I think the script came together in about, you know, I think we'd done the first draft within 6 weeks, and we refined it over the next couple of months. So it was, all in all, it was a pretty expedient process, but I think it paid off from leaving it alone for a while and being able to sort of absorb other material in. And the element that we've introduced, which is sort of fleshing out, as you say, the bios, the backstory of who these people are and giving them context, that actually came from our interest in another work that we were developing, which looked at this sort of long shadow that, you know, institutional care and the failings of institutional care here in New Zealand as well as around the world have and currently still have, and how that's intergenerational. So that was being explored on a different project, and it started to find its way into Coming Home in the Dark. And it sort of was quite symbiotic in a lot of ways. It was just a case of going, well, actually, we can connect the dots between aspects of these two stories and these two genres. And, you know, along the way, in terms of detail and things like that. I've have a number of friends who have who I met through research processes, who have had experience as residents of, you know, these boys' homes in New Zealand, and you know, they were very generous in allowing us access and giving us permission to, you know, help keep an authenticity and look at the questions that come from this failing of these homes and you know, the really horrible legacy that they've left behind.
Yeah, and it feels very contemporary indeed, you know, like, because over the last several years there's been a lot of things in the news about institutions, you know, like you say, all over the world. You know, like I remember just last year there was a big scandal in Canada about residential schools and the way they treated First Nation people, and it's you know, and Catholic institutions and various places and various parts of the world. So it does feel very contemporary.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I got asked a little while ago by somebody in a Q&A about, was that a conscious decision to try and sort of cash in on, you know, something that's in the zeitgeist at the moment? But I mean, you know, we wrote this probably about 4 years ago now.
Right.
And it was sort of felt that even though we had been exploring it very much, you know, with through another project, it was good that we could, you know, and this was the highest compliment we could have been paid from, you know, some people who had been through those institutions, is just sort of cementing. So even though our film is a fiction, it's cementing and getting the topic out there and on record, because for so long, so much of this world has been, you know, pushed to the side, swept under the rug, and has never been documented anywhere. So it was good to sort of, you know, try and reach an audience and just get them to consider what this what is actually in our history, as it were. I've just been joined by one of my daughters. You'll have to excuse me just for a moment there.
No problem.
Come on. Sorry about that, Scott. It's he hasn't seen the film, I can assure you.
Yeah, I'm I can imagine probably leaving that for some years.
it's all part of you know, the glamour of working in the film industry now, is that you know, because of COVID and the world being as it is, you know, Zoom calls, you know, it doesn't matter who you are or how important you are, there's a good chance that your children will interrupt what you have to say at some point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It doesn't matter if you're a CEO or a politician or what you are, you know, like there's been various examples of that, like in the news and stuff. And there was, like, I remember in the UK, there was an example of that. Somebody was getting interviewed in the BBC, and a kid just walked in. So obviously, they have no idea. They're not like, oh, the BBC are on the phone, you know? Like,
no, it's good. It keeps everyone real.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. A kind of a jolly interruption after, you know, talking about the incredibly sad and legacy of the kind of institutions that we're talking about before. I suppose that's what I was going to, I kind of lost my train of thought, but like, yes, that's kind of what I was going to ask you about, actually. Do you think in some ways through fiction, through horror, you can place messages like that and provoke thought in people about dark charity like that, about the kind of the shadow of these kind of institutions in a more digestible way than like the news? Because sometimes I feel like, you know, people can interact with fiction, with horror, in a better way than just seeing a headline in the Guardian or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do. And I mean, look, I think that's one of the great powers of horror, and it's, you know, something that horror, especially in literature, has always had. It's how does one make something digestible, as you say, or palatable to an audience? I always think of, you know, what great horror does, sort of like great comedy, is that, you know, it opens your mouths with screams or laughter, and then it throws something serious down your throat for you to digest and ruminate on afterwards. And there's many films, many horror books that have done that, and those have always been sort of a huge inspiration for me. But it's a very different proposition with, you know, I think, you know, we, especially now, and obviously there's a level of distrust in the media and information and how that's being shared, which will probably be around for a long time. I think people have a tendency to turn off from the news and disassociate, or at least put it at arm's length. You can be moved, obviously. Ultimately, what you're seeing feels something that is happening over there. It's something that's happening, you know, even if that's nearby, it's something that's happening over there to some other person, and it might be getting close. Where fiction, any kind of fiction, asks and requires an audience to sort of engage in the story and the proposition or the intention of the story in a way that speaks to, you know, your heart, your mind, and your soul, and your soul through imagination. And it does that by provoking, you know, and preying upon your own fears, or contemplating a question that you had never thought to examine in the first place. And that's something with, you know, Coming Home in the Dark in particular. Obviously, we've got, you can objectively go, there are a couple of protagonists, and there are a couple of antagonists, and there's these two groups at war with each other in Coming Home in the Dark. But, you know, Eli and I were always very wary of going, we want to make good guys and bad guys in this story. Ultimately, you know, we're drawn to stories that are about the grey. It's about that space in between, and people are grey. No one is black and white. And
for sure,
even though, you know, the characters like Mandrake, you know, commit some horrendous acts, which are, you know, irredeemable acts almost, you know, in this film, and should be held accountable for them. You know, we like the fact that we muddy the waters there. We sort of give an insight, not an excuse, but an insight as to, you know, violence begets more violence, and this cyclical nature to trauma and violence handing down from one generation to the next. And same with, you know, the protagonist Hoagie, you know, is a man who, you know, is we can empathize with, but as the story goes on, you start to, you know, find things out about this person, which you start to then question your initial judgments you had on them. And that's the power of story to me. That's and particularly horror, because it does play around in that gray space and unpacking those things. But if you're, you know, it's, I mean, I've listened to, with the recent Royal Commission, I've listened to all of the interviews from residents and the bravery that they've done, that they've, you know, faced and putting their stories out there. But I can see that is also, that's a very tough ask for people to listen to. It's a tough ask for them to do it, and they're doing it because they want to see real change. But again, it's the reality can really turn people away. And we were always interested in going, well, who are those audiences that that you know, advocates for, you know, reconciling those wrongs of the past aren't reaching? And to me, that's, you know, that's the regular Joe Bloggs who don't watch the news. That's people who do enjoy film. They do enjoy, you know, literature. How do we start to speak to them in a way that's not didactic? It's through the power of story and personalizing that through through a fiction.
It's one of those things, is like you say, you know, like watching interviews from something like that, like the Royal Commission, it can become overwhelming in terms of just how bleak and depressing it is, and sometimes you can take so much of that and then want to put it at arm's length, whereas like by putting it in a I hesitate to say your film's entertaining. Not that it's, I really enjoyed it. It's a good film, but entertaining makes it sound kind of lighter than it is. But you know, putting in a form that is that kind of more palatable kind of does make it easier to think about these things while engaging with a fiction.
Yeah. And you know, and I completely know what you mean about, you know, it's not an entertainment where, you know, I grew up on films, you know, that did provoke, that were confronting, they were ugly, you know, the themes were ugly, but they also, you know, there's great beauty and there's great knowledge to be unpacked in the ugly, and I think it's very problematic when we just pursue the popcorn and the escapism of film, and you know, we're very aware that, you know, there's, even though technically if you go back and look at this film, there's actually very little violence shown on the screen. There's very little blood. There's very little, you don't see a hell of a lot, you know, of injuries happening before your eyes. It's all implied violence, but the feeling overall is that of a very dangerous film. These feel very, very real. And so we were very committed to going, well, how do we not show away, but also we don't want to make an exploitation. Because that doesn't feel like it lines up with the vision of what we're trying, and you know, the intention of what we're talking about. So it was really fun working out that balance of how do we still deliver to those genre beats and those genre aspects, but without ever betraying what our core intention is, what we're saying, what we're wanting to say through story, and you know. That's something we kind of had to fight for too, right from the script stage. You know, there were a number of, it was very hard to get financed initially, finding a market partner. I mean, it's always hard for a first time director, but you know, a lot of people sort of felt that, you know, if, you know, they wanted to sort of soften aspects or black and white certain aspects, so there is a clearer distinction between good guys and bad guys, and you know, even just speaking in those terms, it's so we were very lucky to, you know, stick to our guns and find the right partners who were really backing that, and you know, it was and to premiere at the Sundance Film Festival last year, before going on to tour around the world and then land on Netflix. It's been really great to see that there's an audience out there, an audience hungry for this kind of film as well.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about it. I was kind of interested in terms of that, of like getting it financed or whatever, because like I'm not an expert on New Zealand horror film, but certainly from what I've seen in terms of the New Zealand horror films I have seen, I feel that your film is unusual in New Zealand horror, because I feel that most of the New Zealand horror films that I've seen, whether it's the out and out comedy of something like What We Do in the Shadows, or the kind of over the top gore of a Peter Jackson film, or even the, you know, super bleak comedy of something like Come to Daddy, there's always humor seems to always be involved in New Zealand horror. And watching your film, it has like a nasty, hard edge that I associate more with Australian horror than I do New Zealand horror. So it seems quite unusual to me in that aspect.
Yeah, we've I know what you mean. It's and it does feel, you know, it does feel very at home with our Australasian contemporaries, and you know, I've obviously, you know, drawn on a lot of those films as well. I mean, one of the inspirations for certain aspects of Coming Home in the Dark, even though you wouldn't necessarily be able to see it on the surface, but you know, Wake and Fright, the Ted Cox film, which in itself, you know, is a drama, but to me, you know, I think it reads as a horror film as well, as the great Australian, you know, lost film for a while. There was a huge influence on me for this in particular. But I mean, it's funny. It's look, and I love all those films that you've mentioned from you know, our filmmakers. But I often look at the canon of New Zealand film, and I actually think we've made lots of horror films. I just think we call them dramas here in New Zealand. You know, right. I mean, in many ways, you know, how can you, you know, deny the horror of that is Once Were Warriors, as well as being, you know, incredibly uplifting story in many subtle ways. You know, how do you deny the absolute terror and insanity and madness that is Heavenly Creatures?
True.
Or even, you know, the you know, tracing the actual effects and events that took place in Aramoana and Out of the Blue. You know, these are films which deal with some, you know, really, really confronting subject matter in a dramatic way. But I often think that's where New Zealand has sort of really explored some more personal notions of horror. They just haven't necessarily done it through a genre lens, and that's sort of where I'm, you know, my big passion is genre, across genre. But you know, those who know me well wouldn't deny that my tastes do lend themselves to the darker material. But I think it's you know, I like to ask people what they think is the flavor of horror from Aotearoa New Zealand. You know, you can argue that America has, you know, all sorts of, you know, from slashes to, you know, alien abductions, or the Italians have giallo, which comes from their, you know, the yellow crime thriller horror pulp paperbacks. But what is New Zealand's horror? And I always think it comes from a sense of deep isolation, which has its pros but definitely has its cons. We are an isolated community, and this tension that exists between within a colonized land, and this sort of punitive aspect that comes through in our character at times, definitely through our social histories and our cultural history. But it, you know, it really does sort of stem back to old Blighty. And I say that as, you know, as being half English myself. My father's English, my mother's Māori. So that's where I relate to. That's what I see as being characteristic of New Zealand horror. And you know, you may choose to explore that with a humorous lens, like, you know, Peter Jackson's Braindead is one of my favorite films, you know, not only from New Zealand but worldwide. And you know, that is a very, very subtle and clever commentary on many things to do with this punitive island in the Pacific, that is under the thumb of the Queen's rule. Peter's very, very subtle and subverse in the way he sort of does that. And he's doing it at the same time juggling some of those, you know, those traditional horror tropes from genre as well. But I don't know, it just would have, Mandrake tells a few jokes. They're not very funny, but, you know, you know, they're meant to be a bit, you know, out of place, which again sort of felt, you know, in the punitive vein that, you know, he's the one who's in control with this. But I like New Zealand. Yeah, the canon that we have in terms of cinema, and I do look at some of these films, just like Wake and Fright. You know, I do think some of our greatest dramas are actually, they play equally as well as character driven horror films.
I can totally get where you're coming from. And you mentioned the character of Mandrake there. I was also kind of interested in the character of Mandrake has such a kind of peculiar, intense energy. And I was wondering how difficult it was to cast that character.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we cast, you know, the best actor for the role, which was Dan Gillies, who was great to work with. But funnily enough, initially in the list of people that I was looking at, Dan wasn't on that, and he got wind of the project and he pursued a meeting with me when I was in LA doing casting, and I thought, I'll agree and have a coffee with this guy and meet him, and we'll have a chat, and that'll be that. You know, I only really knew Dan from his work in The Vampire Diaries and the originals and things like that. And obviously he's a very, you know, clean cut, you know, chiseled jaw, handsome fellow. So he wasn't sort of in my mind of what Mandrake physically looked like. But, you know, we ended up talking for 3 hours. And what I really admired about Dan was that, you know, he got the intention of the film, and he was able to speak to the intention throughout all the scenes in the script. He wasn't just aiming and trying to sort of convince me around the character of Mandrake. He talked to the whole, which was really encouraging, because in a, you know, really good, very clear view that this guy is engaging with the material on a whole, and all the things we're trying to achieve, not just the character. And, you know, he was somebody who I just got a sense was, you know, as a first-time filmmaker, he was somebody who was going to get behind the film and commit to it as much as I was. You know, he was somebody who was himself wanting to shrug off some of those preconceptions people had of him, that, you know, sometimes, you know, actors have when they're in a long-term gig, like, you know, the originals, where he's playing, you know, a sexy vampire ad nauseum. You know, he's got other tools in the bag that he is, you know, wanting to showcase and wanting to utilize and have a challenge in order to sort of activate some of those. So I felt, you know, at the end of the day, initially it wasn't a choice that I had considered, but when we met, I got a very clear sense of here's a creative collaborator who's the right fit for the material, who is going to commit to the material as much as me, and who is, you know, very generously, as a first-time director, he's going to put himself in my hands and put himself at my disposal, and that's what he did. And every time that, you know, the horse, the project bucked him off out of the saddle, and, you know, he just got back up on, and he just kept on, you know, exploring and finding and going for it. And, you know, we found the character together during that shoot. It was very surprising. He brought things to Mandrake that I had never considered. And he also, you know, really amplified some of those aspects that, you know, that
What sense did he bring things you hadn't considered?
Well, he sort of just, there was a boyishness actually to Daniel, I think, that he really embraced, because I always saw, you know, Tubbs as somebody as sort of being like a slightly a strange kind of boy man, even though he's incredibly intense and big and intimidating in terms of his physique. I always sort of saw Mandrake is, you know, a much more mature, older, you know, old boot kind of thing, or you know, a roll your own cigarette that's been in your denim jacket pocket for like 6 months. That's how I sort of always saw.
Yeah, right.
Like, and what Dan brings is that at times there's a real youthfulness. Like, you do catch glimpses of, despite the gruff exterior and the dirt and the facial hair, you know, you do get a sense that there's a boy there. There's somebody who's been arrested somewhere along the way in their development. There's a sort of a slight schoolboy immaturity at times, which is, you know, really effective when it's played in situations that aren't where A, you don't expect that, or it's completely inappropriate. So I really liked that aspect that he brought out, because at the end of the day, we are talking about, you know, what happens to children, you know, the death of children, whether that's physically, spiritually, or emotionally. And, you know, I think it was very important that we were able to see the boy in the man with both Mandrake and Tubbs as characters.
Yeah, yeah. And you definitely can. And, Daniel's great in the movie. And it's like a kind of terrifyingly committed performance. It's a really unnerving character. The thing that I thought about most throughout the movie was, I don't know if you've seen Last House on the Left. The original, like the David Hesse's Krug, is kind of the character I thought about the most when thinking about Mandrake.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, there's that, you know, that sort of less so in the remake, but in the original, that sort of immaturity, you know, violent immaturity, you know, it's like a violent toddler. Mm-hmm. You know, when the tantrum comes, it's just going to be, you know, it's going to have much more, you know, bigger repercussions. You know, it's lovely, because when people are like that, you can't take your eyes off them.
Yeah.
You know, they are very arresting and they're unpredictable. And I think that's essential for any actor to have.
Yeah. I think it was that. I think it was certainly in terms of the character from the original, Krug in the original Last House on the Left does have that kind of violent immaturity, and also the sense of himself of being very clever. Like, he likes to think of himself as being very clever, much like Mandrake, and this kind of the kind of pretensions, and also this kind of childishness. And I felt, yeah, the characters kind of, and just the fact that they're both characters that really get under your skin in a way that a lot of typical slasher villains don't.
Yeah. I mean, it's a real thing. I mean, I think, you know, we've all probably had an experience with a bully at some stage. Sure. In our life, or in fact, being the bully, perhaps. But, you know, that from the bullies that I remember from childhood, or people who I've known who sort of, you know, can at times exhibit that kind of behaviour, there is a sense of flexing one's muscles. You know, in this case, Mandrake sort of, you know, he's loquacious, he's verbose, he likes to chat, he likes to sort of flex his intellectual muscles to let everyone know that he can also play this game. Mm-hmm. That they're not as good as him. It's very surface level bluster in many ways. But obviously once you get through that surface and you know, that's when things get dangerous and he reacts. But to me, it's always, I always find that with bullies, there's always a sense of they're holding the mirror up to themselves when they're committing these actions because of that deep sense of insecurity. and needing that to be, you know, that sense of ego to be stroked in order for them to exist in the world. They can't feel big unless somebody else feels small. And
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So he's somebody who's going, you know, he can do that physically, no problem. We already established that very quickly, that he asserts that dominance physically over his victims. But, you know, being a sadist, obviously, it's a case of going like, well, now we've got everyone in the confines of this pressure cooker, which is the car, the journey through the night. I'm going to do the exact same thing, just within these close quarters, though. And that's, to me, the much more frightening and insidious aspects in those scenes, carry the threat of violence is always much more potent than the act itself.
I think that's quite realistic in a way as well, because, I mean, certainly from my perspective of being Scottish, like, I think most people in Scotland know the exact type of character you meet in a Scottish pub that always have, even when they're being loquacious and jolly, they always have this kind of air of violence about them, and you always know if you say just the wrong thing at just the wrong moment, then things could kick off. It felt familiar in that sense.
Yeah, I think Mandrake and Begbie would either get along like a house of fire, or they'd be you know, incinerated in each other's company. But, you know, I know exactly what you mean. Begbie as a character from Trainspotting is, you know, he exists. He's real. That was actually a very accurate portrayal of that character.
Yes, and those types of characters can be found in Scottish pubs everywhere.
I stuck to the regular pub that I drank at in Edinburgh, like I said earlier, when I went there, but I fortunately didn't run into anyone like that.
I suppose, like, most regular pubs are fine. It's when you go into the kind of old man kind of football pubs is more you can get that type of character more. They're the type of pubs that you walk into and everybody in the bar looks at you because it has such a regular clientele that a new face is like a completely amazing thing. You know?
but it's the truth, right? It's you know, that's what I think makes for compelling characters, especially in horror, where often, you know, there's, you know, I think the bad rap that horror often gets, and, you know, it's one that's fair to one extent because it's brought it on itself for different things, is that, you know, especially in terms of antagonists, they're painted in broad strokes. You know, they're just seen as a physical threat or a threat to one's life, rather than actually giving them a foundation based in reality and nuance of personality. I find it much more interesting when a character like Tubbs, you find out he actually, you know, really loves, you know, Chopin or Grieg. You know, it's gives him as a character, I think, a level of, you know, a depth, and it just opens up my imagination to dream on what other aspects there are to a character who I have made some very hard and fast, you know, I've had some hard and fast preconceived ideas based on what they've done earlier in the film. And now those are being challenged by something as simple as, you know, revealing their taste in music, which I never would have thought they would have had.
And it can leave a kind of longer impression as well, I believe. You know, you talked about the fact that your film doesn't have a lot of explicit violence in terms of, like, the violence it shows. It's more the threat of violence. It's the era of violence that is throughout the movie that is the most unsettling thing, and it can leave a longer impression just in the fact that, you know, I watched a new Texas Chainsaw Massacre that came out just last week, and it's filled with gore, like wall-to-wall gore, and I'll probably forget about it in a couple of weeks. And but the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre doesn't have a lot of gore in it, and there's images that have been haunting me since I was 16 when I first saw it, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Look, I may have had this exact conversation on Saturday night when my wife sat down with a whiskey to watch it. I mean, you know, there are lots of different, you know, types of horror within the genre, sure. and they all have their appeal. But fundamentally, you know, you hit the nail on the head with that comparison, because that first one, which at the end of the day, and I always tell people to give the original a go, because it is a really potent film in terms of, like you say, it leaves an impression, it has a visceralness to it in terms of feeling, and it doesn't do it despite the, I mean, that title in itself, there's so much violence implied in that title, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that, you know, I think it really colors people's viewing of but again, some really amazing indie filmmaking in that piece, and the complete opposite end of the scale is obviously the current one, where they did some admirable inventive kills. I'll give them that. They never repeated themselves, despite using predominantly one weapon. But does it stick? Is it going to haunt my sleep? Or is it, you know, those types of stories, like I said at the beginning, that's what I'm always looking for. Those are the stories that I'm attracted to. And, they're hard to find. And, but when they do, it's, you just become obsessed with them. Well, certainly I do.
I was wondering as well, were you taken aback at all of just how much the movie took off? I mean, I was hearing, you know, obviously I've had this podcast for a few years, and keep an eye on all the horror film festivals and film festivals that have got horror in them. And, it, you know, your film came up again and again in various festivals last year. And, you know, it was one of the most talked about, I would say one of the most talked about horror films of last year on the festival circuit. Were you kind of like, how was that for you?
Oh, look, I mean, it was great. I mean, it was in terms of, you know, in some ways, I sort of once we got into Sundance and that was announced, that in itself was just great to know that, you know, you push your baby out to sea and it floats, and other people are welcoming it into their ports. So it's a great sort of validation to finally go like, okay, let's put this out into the world and see what happens and have it land. So that was a huge relief, and Sundance being obviously the festival that it is, it was a great way to launch it into the world. But the fact that it did keep on getting picked up and playing at lots of different festivals all around the world was not so much a great compliment, but it was more of an affirmation of like, oh, okay, cool. Our intention was clear, or is finding its audience. It's landing with people, that people do want to talk about this, or they do want to engage with this. So it was very, you know, affirming, you know, instinctually. But also, you know, it's been in terms of the business and career, it's been, you know, a wonderful, it's exceeded every fantasy that I could possibly have entertained about it. And, you know, I've got more work from it, you know, different kinds of work, and, you know, very good representation. And it's been a real life changer of a year. That's been, but again, it's more the thing I enjoy most was that you know, you that there are people out there who want to look at the same things as you and engage in them, not just as an entertainment, but as a film, as a story, looking at the kinds of themes that, you know, I'm compelled to explore. So that was, you know, and of course made it in the worst possible time because, you know, I couldn't go anywhere, experience it all from this room.
Yeah,
and
even
that kind of sucked it in one sense. I can't help but feel that also helped, and not just, you know, our film, but this helped with many other films. It actually, especially with Sundance, it really drove people to go online and watch the films in their entirety. So I think there was a real sense that industry, as well as audiences who wouldn't normally get to experience a festival like that, were able to engage in the variety of films that were made. So that was really good, even though we couldn't necessarily be there and, you know, sort of experience the hoopla that is the festival. But it's also been very, you know, it's been emboldening, you know, being on Zoom and, you know, discussing things and meeting, you know, some very, you know, influential people and, you know, seeing what the inside of their study wall looks like, or, you know, how messy their house is and things like that, you know, it's been, which, you know, might have been a bit overwhelming, who knows, you know, in person. So it's been a really great year of, you know, building relationships and projects via Zoom. What's exciting now, obviously, and what's getting closer is actually going into production and getting back on the floor with creative collaborators and practically engaging in the storytelling in a visceral way.
And so I was reading that one of the projects you're attached to is this adaptation of the Max Brooks novel Devolution. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's I mean, I've never been a Sasquatch fan, I have to say.
To be fair, there's not a lot of good Bigfoot movies.
I couldn't believe how many Bigfoot movies there actually were.
There's tons.
I mean, there were the sort of stalwarts that I knew, but you go into this sort of cryptid cinema, and it was huge for a while there. Mm-hmm. You're right. Very few were good, but even in paperback horror in the 70s and early 80s, there is a huge swath of Bigfoot novels, going from, you know, hunting Bigfoot to, then there was a period where there was like sexy Bigfoot, that women started, you know, that he has this, you know, this amorous quality, and then there was Bigfoot meets aliens. And it's just sort of like, what what's going on with this guy? Like, why him why this creature out of all other creatures is sort of getting this kind of treatment? So
I don't know. It seems to be a very American thing as well. I've not encountered a lot of Bigfoot fiction from like other places. It's generally a very American thing, I would say.
Yeah, and it's and you know, usually, you know, obviously too, that there's very little to do with actually, you know, looking at the mythology, the cultural or spiritual implications that you know Sasquatch has to do with mm-hmm. Native American culture and those elements as well. They've sort of either been, you know, they're sort of either made very decorative or just completely ignored whatsoever. So what was really refreshing when I read Max Brooks' novel, and I love Max Brooks' World War Z. I thought that was an amazing book. It was really good film too. It was different, obviously, to the book, but Max brings such a researcher's perspective, a level of detail into his storytelling that is very fact-based and Darwinian. So that was actually, that for me was a really strong way that, you know, that he chose to ground that creature, and really just treating it as an animal, a very advanced animal, essentially. But the thing I loved the most about Max's book was that, you know, Bigfoot aside, what it really is about that fundamental thing which I'm always drawn to, which is about the, you know, the duality of people, that when you put people under extreme pressure and duress, how does that alter and shape how they react, and how does that sort of bring forth what's truly inside people, and how that shapes them? And that, and that for me was the, you know, the reason I fell in love with Devolution as a work to adapt. And look, it was just really, really fortunate. Legendary Entertainment, who are responsible for Dune as well as the latest Texas Chainsaw Massacre film. there's two polar opposite films right there for you. They're a really great, creative and very supportive, artist supportive studio. And they really liked the pitch that I gave for the project. And so we were really fortunate that Eli Kent, again, who is sort of my closest collaborative partner, we wrote the script, and it's sort of got fast-tracked. So it's looking like it might show up, move into production rather quickly.
Oh.
So it's, yeah, we'll see. We'll see, okay. But it's... yeah, it's definitely moving forward at a great rate of knots, that one. And it's an intimidating prospect, you know. It's a big film. It's you know, going to challenge me. It's going to be a big learning curve in terms of, you know, the aspects of VFX and practicals that are involved in terms of creating these creatures. But also it's an actor's film, I think, at its core. It's got some great characters. The way we pitched it to Legendary was a sort of what starts off as the Poseidon adventure, you know, sort of slowly morphs into an adult-driven Jurassic Park and ends in Straw Dogs. So that's sort of the grounding we've given it, and again wanting to be really adult with going like, yeah, here's an adult horror thriller, because the biggest thing that we have to sort of, I think, again, the biggest challenge is getting people over that hump that is Bigfoot, and really sort of you know, undoing the damage that Harry and the Hendersons has done to Bigfoot since like 1986 or whenever it was that film was made.
Yeah, I think it was around then, 86, 87, something like that. So, yeah, I guess so. Getting over that kind of hump. But it sounds like a very intriguing project. I'm very interested to see it whenever it comes out.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll be climbing the mountain that is Sasquatch very soon.
Excellent. So is that your main focus at the moment, or do you have any other projects on the boil?
No, we've also attached to another work, which I'm probably not allowed to say what it is, but that's working with a lovely company, Agbo, in the States, run by the Russo family, the Russo brothers.
Oh, okay.
Marvel. And again, that's another adaptation of a well-known book. But Eli and I also have a number of other projects. We've got another Owen Marshall adaptation of a short story, The Rule of Jenny Penn, which is was actually the first script that we had written together, and is one that we're very passionate about, and is an amazing short story and the perspective he has on that. So it equally as dark as Coming Home in the Dark, but it definitely does have a much more foregrounded, you know, vein of black humour in it, black comedy. And a couple of other adaptations. We're working on a Peter Straub, the first novel in three Peter Straub works called Coco, which Peter Straub was, he's written three books with Stephen King, and he's an author who's been of huge influence on me since I was a kid. His work is very dense. It's quite sprawling in terms of its subject matter, but he again is one of those great examples of literary horror. He is able to work within a genre, but these stories are just as rich, nuanced, and detailed as you know anything that you'd find across genres.
Yeah.
He's just an amazing writer and a prolific writer. And it's, I think, one of the reasons why his works have not made the transition to adaptation in terms of film so much compared to, say, someone like Stephen King as contemporary, is that they are so dense. But with, limited series and ongoing series, now we have this format where we're able to, you know, have time to explore and unravel work like Peter's in a way that, you know, you can really, you know, you can tackle the whole rather than trying to, you know, cut it in half and squeeze it into a 2-hour film.
Yeah. I feel like it's a name you don't hear much. Now, like, just in terms of, I know there's a couple of adaptation of Peter Straub works in the kind of 70s and early 80s, but I can't think of one like a more recent one.
No, I mean, they did Ghost Story, which was one of his biggest works.
Yes.
And I'm quite fond of the film for sentimental reasons, but I mean, it's an atrocious film. It's
I know it by reputation. I've never actually sat down and watched it. I know it's the novel is supposed to be many times better, and it's not supposed to be a very good film.
But again, it's like that novel is so huge and sprawling in terms of what it's proposing and the depth that it goes into its characters. You know, it's sort of like it's like a foot. They were able to, you know, cut off a foot of the book and fit it into the film. Unfortunately, it was the left foot they chose, and then it had Fred Astaire in it. He should have been able to make it work, but it's one of those films that shows its age.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it, all the time. But you know, The Haunting of Julia is the other one, which is based on If You Could See Me Now, is that what it's based on?
I'm not sure whether I actually have seen that one with Mia Farrow. It says,
So, and again, that was a little more, you know, that's a little more faithful because it was a condensed book, and you know, it's sort of a drama, a drawing room drama in many ways. But you know, Coco, which is one of his, which is probably, you know, for my money, is one of his biggest, most well-known works, is it's just huge. It's a mammoth work. I mean, even as a limited series, you know, it's been quite a task to contain it, and because it's all so rich, it really is a case of, you know, it's so good. There's so much detail in there, which was, which, you know, you'd be happy to go down the rabbit hole and follow if we went there as a series. You know, every character you could quite happily sort of follow if they turn left or right and stay with them and see where they go and how they develop. But it's just a real privilege to be working on it, frankly. I mean, it's a book that I've I owned since I was 10 years old. I wasn't, it's not a book 10-year-old should read, I have to say, but it took me about a decade to read it because it's the size of the phone book. But it's just such rich material that it makes it really, it's a real joy to be working on and to be working on the work of one of, your big heroes, your influences.
Well, it sounds like you've got a whole stack of really interesting projects coming up, and I'd be very interested to see all of them when they come out, and I'm sure my listeners will too. But I feel like that's a pretty neat way to come to the conclusion of this interview. And so it just leaves me to say thank you very much, James, for coming on the show. And please do come back on again. Hopefully you won't have like a big fancy agent and I won't be able to interview you because I'm such a small, fine podcast by that stage. And I like you.
No, not at all. Always keen to, converse and talk with homegrown and, people with an interest here, because it's, for a long time, growing up, I felt like, the big question was like, where's my community? Where are the people who are interested in the same things as me? And I think that's really one of the main reasons people create, is to sort of send that signal out to try and find, those other like-minded people. So it's been great to chat with you, Scott. Thank you. So no, definitely be back.
That was my guest, James there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Unfortunately, that is all for this time, but be sure to join me next time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.